This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Mentally, I'll be honest with you, still feel like I'm in prison. Not that easy to get over that mental part. I'm physically out here, but my mind is still kind of in prison.
I'm Damian Bulwa, and this is Fifth and Mission. That voice you just heard was Hamed Hayat, a Muslim American man who paid a heavy price, including 14 years behind bars, for America's fear of terrorism after 9/11. You might have heard of Hamed before. He grew up in a Pakistani-American family in Lodi, just east of the Bay Area. His father was the neighborhood ice cream man. But his life changed when an FBI informant named Nasim Khan moved to town, befriended Hamed, and began to secretly record their conversations. In May 2005, in a story that made international headlines, Hamed and his father were arrested. In an FBI interrogation, Hamed confessed to attending a terrorist training camp during a trip to Pakistan. Or at least that's what the government said. When Hamed was convicted, it seemed like the end of the story. But Hamed and his attorneys waged a long legal fight to overturn that conviction. And they succeeded. In 2019, Hamed walked out of prison ready to restart his life. But how do you do that? That's the question that Chronicle reporter Jason Fagoni wanted to ask when he began to follow Hamed more than a year ago and talk to him about his life. My guest today is Jason Fagoni, and throughout this episode, you'll also hear Hamed Hayat speaking from interviews that Jason conducted. To read Jason's full story, please go to sfchronicle.com/Hayat. That's H-A-Y-A-T. Jason, an incredible story. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Jason, who is Hamed Hayat, and why did you want to follow him and write about him? What was it about his case that you wanted to learn more about?
Yeah, so Hamed's case was one of the most famous, high-profile terrorism cases of the post-9/11 era. It was a big deal then. It was national, international news. There were news crews covering the trial from all over the world. And the government said it was a big deal, told the public it was important because it showed, they said, that they could prevent terrorist attacks by discovering sleeper cells here in the homeland and disrupting them. And they presented the arrest and prosecution and ultimately the conviction of Hamed as a win for America and American security. But later on, the case became famous for a different reason that you mentioned, which is that it fell apart. And the conviction was reversed and the charges against him were dropped. And I'm always interested in stories about wrongful convictions. I guess I was interested in Hamed for a couple of reasons. You know, one is that he represents a whole group of young Muslim American men who were targeted after 9/11 by the FBI, you know, in some cases on thin evidence. And they were put under surveillance, mosques were infiltrated, you know, informants were recruited and paid. And I guess I was curious what it was like for someone to be on the other side of that, someone like Hamed. And I noticed something too when I read about the case. I mean, there's been a lot of terrific journalism done on Hamed in his case, including by you, Damien. I'm not sucking up to you. The listeners should know that Damien covered the case and covered the trial back in 2005, 2006, right? And of course, these are clips that I read before I started my work on the story. There's been a lot of terrific reporting. You know, great investigative reporters have really sunk their teeth into it and have exposed a lot of the problems in the case well before the story. But you know, reading a lot of that work, it was clear that you know Hamed had never really participated in the stories about him, and it didn't seem like he had spoken at length with journalists or answered questions about what he was thinking or feeling throughout this whole process. And you know, all this stuff had been written about him, and he was kind of absent in it. And I didn't know if he'd be willing to talk, but I thought it would be worth reaching out and asking.
Well, thanks for the shout out, Jason. And you're right. I mean, It was very frustrating not to be able to speak to Hamid Hayat, which is often the case in a criminal matter. And not only was he unable to speak in the beginning, but during his whole appeals process, of course, he was unable to speak. Right. So I was really intrigued when you began following him. I wonder how you connected with Hamid. Was he ready to talk about his ordeal? Did you have to build a relationship with him, build trust?
Yeah, I did. So I started by contacting his appellate attorney, his lead appellate attorney, Dennis Reardon, who's the one who led this team, this legal team that spent more than a decade on the case, trying to overturn the conviction, get Hamid out of prison, and ultimately succeeded. Reardon is a central person in Hamid's life in a lot of ways. And I think he had been looking for a way to help Hamid tell his story. In his own words, with his own voice. I think originally they had been planning to have some kind of press conference, but that was before the COVID pandemic hit and the plans for that got scotched. And then I came along and asked if Hamid would be willing to talk with me. And I guess the timing just happened to be right. So I started interviewing Hamid first with Reardon present, and then ultimately, just me and Hamid speaking, asking him about pretty much every aspect of what he'd been through. And at first, we did the interviews by Zoom. I think at the time, his father was still dealing with the aftermath of a COVID diagnosis. And then once Hamid felt comfortable, we spent time together in person, and I met his family, ended up speaking with a bunch of his relatives, friends, and people he was in prison with. And even with his permission, his therapist.
My mental state is just, I still kind of have a sense of being in prison, honestly. Not used to being around so many people out here, too many people around me and everything. I'm adjusting, but it's taking time, actually, being around so many people at once. It's just fast moving out here. It's more faster than what I'm used to.
That's Hamid Hayat, who spent 14 years in prison after being convicted on charges of supporting terrorism, a conviction that was ultimately overturned. I want to get to the time that you spent with him and ask you what Hamid's like and how he's trying to rebuild his life. But there is something that's so striking in your work, Jason, that I've rarely seen before, which is that you paint a vivid picture of prison life for Hamid Hayat, talking to him and, as you say, to inmates that were there at the same time. What did you learn by doing that?
Yeah, I mean, so Hamid's time in prison was actually mostly what we talked about at first, because it's still vivid to him. And I think that's true for a lot of people who have been through long incarcerations, is that they're still very much imprinted by their time in prison. That's very much true for Hamid. So no one who met Hamid in prison thought that he could have committed a terrorist attack. It was really striking. His first years in prison, he spent at this this unusual secretive place that the government spun up after 9/11 called the Communications Management Unit. It had a nickname, Little Gitmo, a reference to Guantanamo Bay. And this was not a place where the worst or the highest profile terrorists, terror convicts were placed. Those people tended to go to a supermax prison. But this was sort of the second tier terror convicts, I guess. And Hamid ended up there as one of the younger men. And I spoke with some of the guys who were in this secretive unit with him. And it was really clear that a lot of them looked at Hamid and they were confused about what he was doing there. I mean, he just did not seem to belong, even in this place that was designed to isolate people, right? Where no one naturally belongs. And he struck people there, other incarcerated guys as very simple and shy and humble. And more than that, some of the prisoners who were educated recognized when they talked with Hamid that he did not fit the mold of an Islamic radical, because he understood his own religious tradition very poorly. I interviewed some of these guys and they really liked Hamid a lot. And they also were just baffled by his attitude and his failure to grasp the very sort of basic elements of Sunni Islam. And one of them got so frustrated with Hamid one time that he told him to his face, he said, "You're no terrorist, you're a tourist." And this was the pattern that repeated throughout Hamid's years of incarceration. He would be transferred to a new prison. You know, people in the prison would hear that he was some kind of famous terror convict, and then they would meet him, and they would be baffled. And eventually, Hamid, you know, over years, he won over a number of prison employees, even who began to kind of root for him to win his freedom. And he's actually still in touch with some of these people today.
Before we get to that freedom that he finds, Jason, I do think there's one point that we need to make clear here. The center of the case against Hamid Hayat was that he had confessed to going to a terrorist training camp. And ultimately, what he and his attorney said was that it was a false confession. In your talks with him, did you ask him, you know, why did you confess? Why did you break down in interrogation?
Sure. Well, I think it can be hard for people to understand intuitively why someone would ever admit to a crime that they did not do. It's certainly difficult for juries to understand this often. But, you know, what Hamid told me was that when he was in this FBI interrogation, he was confused and he was tired. And he initially denied that he had ever attended a terror camp. He actually denied it multiple times. So the FBI interacted with him on multiple days. First in late May, when he was returning from a trip to Pakistan, they asked him, you know, did you spend any time with a terrorist or at a camp in Pakistan? He said, no, I went there to get married. I was on a family trip. You know, several days later, two FBI agents came to the Hayat home in Lodi and asked the same questions. Hamid again denied everything, said that he, you know, had gotten married, he was on a family trip. And then they asked him to come to FBI headquarters on June 4th, 2005 and answer some more questions. And his father said, you know, he would bring him. They had nothing to fear. They had nothing to hide. So both of them ended up going to FBI headquarters. And that's when, over the course of 16 hours, multiple FBI agents interrogated Hamid and kind of broke him down. And what he says is that he just wanted to leave. He wanted to sleep. And he realized that he was not going to be allowed to leave unless he gave the FBI what they wanted and told them what they wanted to hear. And so he, after initially denying it, he changed his answers and started to tell them that, yes, he had gone to a camp. And, you know, I think this is credible because, you know, this is not, the tapes of the interrogation are not a secret. And you can see on the tapes and you can read in the transcript that, you know, that Hamid is both repeatedly asking to be allowed to sleep. And it's also clear that he does not understand the import of what's really happening to him. There's this kind of heartbreaking line toward the end of the interrogation when one of the FBI agents actually tells Hamid, you know, well, he asked them what's going to happen next. This was after midnight. They'd been interrogating him for hours. And he says, well, what's going to happen next? Where am I going to go? Am I going to come back tomorrow? And they say, no, Hamid, you're going to be arrested. You're going to jail. Do you understand that? And his answer makes it clear that he has no idea what's going on. And he says, well, if today just had, they have some place there where I can go to sleep. That was the confession.
I kept on denying it. And then I just got tired. I'm like, yes, I did. Like, you know, I just confessed to it just so I can, like, they can let me go. Because I was tired and everything. And I just said it so they can let me go. Like, I was just like, man, just, okay, you guys got what you guys want. Can I go? Like, I was tired. I just wanted to, you know, sleep.
Let's take a quick break on Fifth and Mission. To read Jason Fagoni's full story on Hamid Hayat, go to sfchronicle.com/Hayat. That's H-A-Y-A-T.
We'll be right back. You can support the newsroom that creates Fifth Emission by signing up for unlimited access at sfchronicle.com/pod or by downloading the San Francisco Chronicle app.
Welcome back to Fifth and Mission. I'm Damian Bulwa, joined by Chronicle reporter Jason Fagoni. Jason, when Hamid Hayat finally goes free from prison, what is his life like? Is it joyous? Is it frightening? Is he angry at the government for putting him there?
He says he's not angry. He does not seem angry. And this is a remarkable thing about him. He does not appear bitter. He says he has no grudges. Grudges won't do him any good. He appears to be a pretty well-adjusted and happy person. And this is pretty amazing given what he's been through. I mean, just the fact that he does normal things is kind of a triumph. He has, you know, he has a car. He has a cat named Oreo. You know, he has a job. He works at Amazon, actually, in an Amazon fulfillment center in the Stockton area. And his coworkers really like him. And probably most of them don't know his backstory. A few of them do, but a lot don't. And the ones that he has told have told Hamid that they can't believe it, given the way he walks around work with you know, a smile on his face. You know, that said, he has difficult days. He still struggles with sort of symptoms of the long incarceration. People who've been in prison for a long time can exhibit symptoms that resemble PTSD, and Hamid has, you know, struggled with anxiety, insomnia, hypersensitivity to sound, and these are fairly typical of people who've been in prison for a while.
How would you describe him in general after spending time with him? What's he like?
I mean, if you met him and talked to him and had coffee with him, you would not guess that he's been through all of this, right? He strikes me as a guy who is, you know, doing well most days, and he's still kind of trying to figure out the bigger picture, bigger plan of what he's going to do next. He's searching for a purpose or a vocation, and I do get the strong sense that he's torn about telling people his story, you know, and revealing what he's been through, even though he did decide to talk about it with me. You know, he's hesitant about that for obvious reasons, I think, right? Like there's a part of him that really wants to tell people he's close to what he's been through, because it's just a big part of his story. Like the same way that you want to tell a friend or somebody that you're close to what you're all about. I mean, there have been times when he you know, the compulsion was so strong that he would be having lunch with a coworker or something, and he would just suddenly take out his phone and he would say, "Do you know who I am?" And he would Google his own name, right? And they would hand the phone to the coworker, and the coworker would scroll through pages and pages and pages and pages of Google results, and just, you know, with jaw open, because how can this be that guy? How can this be that Hamid Hayat, right? And so that impulse exists to share, but he's also cautious, right? Because of what happened to him. I mean, it's hard for him to walk into a mosque. He says he doesn't know who anyone is. It's hard for him to be around strangers sometimes. And there's some aspect of getting out of prison after that much time where he has to figure out how to grow up again, how to kind of start his life over, you know, make a new life for himself. And how do you do that if you're in his position? You know, what do you do? Where do you go? I don't know. He decided to talk to me, he said, because he feels a duty to talk about it. He doesn't want this kind of thing to happen to anyone else. But there's definitely a big part of him that wants to be anonymous. You know, he told me one time that he wants to go to a place where no one knows who I am.
I want to ask you a little more about the process of reporting a story like this over many months. Ultimately, who was willing to talk to you that was key in this case, and who wasn't, about their roles?
People around Hamid, certainly his advocates, you know, family, were happy to talk about him. I was able to speak with a member of the government trial team, David Deitch, former federal prosecutor. He gave me some of the Department of Justice perspective on the case. I was less successful in reaching FBI agents who worked on the case, and I did not receive any response from the informant, Nassim Khan.
Jason, what happened to two people that you write about? One, Umer Hayat, Hamid's father, and the other, the woman who you mentioned he was planning to marry when all of this happened.
Yeah. So Umer is 64 now. His life has been profoundly disrupted. You know, this case didn't just harm Hamid, it harmed the people around him, the people closest to him, his family. But before all of this, Umer was a breadwinner in the family. He was a vigorous guy. He really enjoyed his job driving the ice cream truck. Yeah, I asked him why he liked it one time. He said, you know, he, before that, he had spent years as a laborer in the field picking fruit. said when he started driving the ice cream truck, you know, the boss man isn't on your back all the time. He really liked it. And then all of this happened. You know, so he refers, all of this he refers to as the tragedy with Hamid. And the tragedy with Hamid left Umar, you know, sapped of resources, sapped of his strength, and drained of his savings because their legal bills were so high. Actually, the family had to sell their house after the trial because they had to spend so much money on legal bills. And for a time, they were living together in a garage. And after that, Umar was unable to find steady, reliable employment in the Lodi area because, you know, whenever he tried, people remembered him from the trial, and they thought he was a terrorist. He was not able to drive his ice cream truck anymore because no one wanted to buy ice cream from somebody they thought was a terrorist. As for Hamid's wife, he says he has not reached out to her after getting out of prison. They ended up divorcing while he was in prison. He lost his marriage as a result of this because, you know, it was just too long to make her wait, he felt.
In the end, Jason, what did you learn from spending time with Hamid Hayat?
Yeah, this is a bad answer, but the answer is that I don't know. I feel like I should have an answer. I was looking at this question when you sent some of the draft questions. I was just thinking, like, how do I answer this? Part of the incredible thing here is that I have no idea what I or any American can really say to Hamid, because what's been taken from him is profound, I think. And what's been taken from his family, these are things that he'll never get back. And so I don't have a pat conclusion about this, right? I guess I just ended up hoping that with story, I could convey to readers some sense of the cost to Hamid and the people around him. You know, the investigation of Hamid and the trial definitely turned him into a sort of caricature. So I hope people who read the story get a sense of him as a three-dimensional human.
Jason Fagoni, thanks for taking the time, and thanks for writing the story. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Damien. What has been the best thing for you about being out of prison? What's been the thing that has brought you the most joy?
Just being a blessing, being out here with family and friends and all the supporters. Honestly, just truly a blessing.
Again, that was Hamid Hayat. Thanks to Jason Fagoni for being my guest today. Please read Jason's story on Hamid in the Chronicle app or online at sfchronicle.com/Hayat. That's H-A-Y-A-T. Thanks also to King Kaufman and Cecilia Lay for producing this episode. And thank you for listening.